Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 98-year-old Nate Murphy of Coronado, California. Originally from Boston, Massachusetts, a decorated dive bomber pilot in World War II, he was twice awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, and we'll hear why later. We're also going to hear about the day his carrier, the USS Wasp, was sunk in the Pacific. But let's pick it up in the Atlantic Ocean with the Wasp ferrying planes across to the British in 1942.
I guess we did two swap where we'd give them control and then I'd get the oncoming the other way and bring it back. Now we're going to go the third time, only we get to halfway point where there is no halfway. We go all the way now to Scotland, go in the Scapa Flow, and they got barrage balloons, and they got, you've never seen so much stuff they had. And we had nothing. I mean, we were just country boys. When we turned over the last group of Spitfires, the British took control and took them on down to Gibraltar and into the Mediterranean, and were all set to get these guys airborne. Somebody alerted the Germans. They wiped out the whole deckload of them. Whether they didn't see it or didn't care, they didn't do anything to the Wasp. Anyway, the ship turned around, went back up to Scapa Flow, load a new deckload of Spitfires, and took off again. The second rundown, we beat them to the punch, and we got them before they got us. So we unloaded them all. So we headed back to Norfolk, Virginia. Then they decided they needed us in the Pacific. We came from Norfolk to San Diego by train. Didn't know where we were going. We shoved off, and we had a minimum of protection. I think we might have had 3 or 4 destroyers.
So you're leaving from San Diego, and you're going to the Pacific, where Midway has already happened.
Midway happened while we were underway.
Right.
But we never had any contact with them.
All right.
And a matter of fact, we didn't know that was going on. I mean, it was not public. They took a beating, but they also gave a beating.
Well, and that was the key. And so many SBD pilots didn't come back from that battle, but the blow they dealt the Japanese was so severe. It was known as such a turning point, and so was the battle for Guadalcanal. But what you experienced at the start of that was not sunshine and roses. What can you tell me about your first day in combat flying off the Wasp toward Guadalcanal?
Well, we did bomb and strafe Guadalcanal and Tulagi.
Tulagi had the two little islands connected by a causeway in the harbor.
That's right, and that was our target.
Gavutu and Tanambogo.
Tanambogo, there you go, Tanambogo.
Yeah. You bombed those islands?
That morning, we were given our target. Tanambogo was our aiming point. We took off before daylight, darker than hell. I mean, I'd never flown that. And we had a 1,000-pound bomb. I'd never flown with a 1,000-pound bomb and didn't want to flow one, but what the hell can you do? So anyway, I was flying number 3 on the captain. Thank God for that. And I was nervous. I was nervous. I'd never done that before, and they wouldn't let us, of course, use lights. And all we had for landing was the exhaust. And if you flew up close enough underneath, you could see the exhaust coming out, and you flew on the exhaust. Well, that's fine. And then along comes another so-and-so, and he signs on me. And he's not supposed to be there, but there he is. What can I do? So I ignore him, and I pay attention to what the captain's doing, because he's going to get us to Guadalcanal. Well, that went fine until this jerk down here who decided that he wanted to see if his guns worked. So he did. He jammed his gun. Hey, that was good, too. I never knew before that with the SPD, it fired through the props. But anyway, he triggers off. And I saw it going by like that, and I thought, oh, boy, this is it. And I thought they were going to shoot us down. I couldn't talk. Couldn't tell me what he was doing. Yeah, just that one burst was all I saw. And so that gave me a little confidence the next morning to know that that really is nobody but our own. So it was the captain, I'm on his wing, and here's this guy down on my wing.
So did you drop that 1,000-pound bomb?
Yeah. In this is a picture of it. You don't want to see it. It's just.
I'd love to see it.
This one's Tanambogo.
So you dropped the bomb that left Tanambogo smoking like that?
Yeah.
I think this story that I'm about to tell you has to do with probably someone from your squadron. But I interviewed a Marine just a few weeks ago who made the initial landing on Gavutu and Tanambogo.
Landed on it.
Yeah. So he ends up on that first day on a high point on Gavutu. It was previously occupied by the Japanese. And he's firing his BAR from this spot across the causeway toward Tanambogo, not knowing that on the roof of his bunker is painted a Japanese flag. And one of the SBDs dropped a 500-pound bomb. He saw it coming right at him and crawled backwards down the hill, got where there was just a little bit of the mountain in front of him, and all the shrapnel went over his head, but he lost his hearing for 3 days.
Is that right?
And eight of his buddies were killed. But how is the SBD going to know those are Americans? It's a Japanese flag that they didn't know was there.
Well, that's right.
But I'm guessing it was probably someone from your squadron. If it was an SBD on that day.
If that was the morning, that would be who it was. But there's so much happens in the whole time that it's hard to isolate.
And I get that. There's so much going on. You have that proverbial fog of war. And the result of your mission that day was that you guys had taken out all the anti-aircraft and shore battery installments that intelligence had identified for you. Job well done. You're there for 2 days. They pull you back. You head south, so you miss out on the Battle of the Eastern Solomons a couple weeks later. In that battle, two carriers, the Enterprise and the Saratoga, are both damaged. They need repairs. So as you head into September 1942, there are only two carriers left operating in the Southwest Pacific. Your ship, the Wasp, and her sister carrier, the Hornet. September 15th, 1942 is the day that I want to ask you about. Our listeners can get online and read all about what happened to the Wasp that day. The carrier was escorting reinforcements to Guadalcanal when three torpedoes from a Japanese submarine struck almost all at once. It produced a chaotic cauldron of explosions, fire, confusion. 193 men died, 366 were wounded, 45 aircraft lost. But yours was one of 26 already up in the air when all this happened, and 25 of those 26 would eventually land safely. That's what we know now, but I want to know what it was like to live it. I'm guessing September 15th, 1942 is a day that you'll never forget.
That's right. We went off that morning on a 15-degree sectors. They sent out 12 SBDs to see if there was any Japs around.
Uh-huh.
Well, there wasn't any until we got back. And sure enough, there was. While we were gone, the Japanese had torpedoed the Wasp. And, of course, we had no way to go because we were too far out. We couldn't get to land. And we didn't have enough fuel to do anything. We had to either ditch the airplane or see if we couldn't land aboard. But nobody told us there was any room to land aboard. So we were in bad shape. My roommate, Bob Escher, he got low on fuel, and he had to land next to a cruiser. And when he did, of course, he had nothing but things in. He pushed his eyes back, and he couldn't. He never flew again. They picked him up, and that was it. So now we've got, I think, 12 SPDs. What are we going to do? Well, some smarty, thank God, from the Hornet said, come on over and land on the Hornet. And so I guess they put their heads together and can we do this thing? What they did, they launched six or eight of their own planes in a one-way shot at the closest island. That cleared the deck for enough airplanes so that we could land aboard the Hornet. So now we're pretty well filled up. So the next morning, the very first thing, they shot us off, all 12 of us, and that was it. So now we're on our own and heading for, well, we were hoping for one island. Of course, we couldn't. They won't talk to you, no radio. We had YEZB, where they every 15 degrees, they put a plane in there, and he searches 15 degrees, 15 degrees. Mm-hmm. And when they come back, now we've got the whole area cleared, and we're in pretty good shape. So they take the SPDs, and they shoot them off all together. They found a place called Espiritu Santos, and at Espiritu Santos, they rendezvoused, and they landed, and the Marines took us under cover.
So this YEZB was a top-secret system of radio homing signals to help guide you back to a carrier. There was a different Morse code letter assigned to each one of those 15-degree sections, and that changed daily to avoid the enemy figuring it all out. So that helped you in this situation where you couldn't communicate. But I want to go back and really understand what all this is like. And not to leave a loose end here, I know you later found out that the Hornet had actually shoved aircraft off the deck and into the ocean to make room for you, in essence, to save your lives. But tell me about this. You take off from your carrier, and you're out there patrolling for hours, right?
We got 250 miles, out 250 over whatever that is, and back.
Just looking for Japanese forces.
That's right.
Never saw anything.
Not that time. That's a routine search. Right. We used to do that at that time every morning and every night.
Now, and the whole point of this is to figure out where the enemy is.
That's right.
But they don't know how close the enemy is because these torpedoes hit the Wasp. So when you're flying back to your carrier, can you tell me what you saw when you were coming back toward the Wasp?
The only thing we could see at first was the black smoke, and you couldn't see anything down here. And the black smoke was coming, and as we got closer, then we saw the airplanes flying around, and we didn't join up. There'd be one here, one there, and each looking for his buddy, you know, because you went in two plane searches. So we finally got organized. John Eldridge, our skipper, he got things going. He was a crackerjack. They got him organized, and then the Hornet broke in with a lamp telling us that what they were going to do. And so we then followed this one guy who picked us up and got to the Hornet, which now probably 50-100 miles away. It had just taken off. They weren't going to get torpedoed.
Can you tell me, and I'm sorry for belaboring the point here, but what it felt like to see, and at this point, you don't know where the Hornet is. You're coming back to the Wasp. The only place you have to land is going up in smoke, and you've got a gunner in the back seat whose life you're also responsible for. What goes through your mind in a situation like that?
Actually, up until the time we decided to let us go with the Hornet, we were a little befuddled. Where are we going to go? No, I mean, you couldn't ask anybody. If you got close enough and you could get a lamp on it, you could do pretty good. But you couldn't do the radio. You couldn't do the whatever.
So you're on your own.
You're on your own until somebody took a hold of you and say, okay, come on, boys.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes because you're 24 years old. You're halfway around the world from everything you know, and now your floating home on the ocean is burning, and you can't go back home. Did you think you were going to make it? Did you think you were going to die that day?
No, I don't have any, to my recollection. It was not good, but it was not, it could be solved. In other words, we had a great deal of respect for our Lieutenant Commander Eldridge, who was an older man. He was probably 32 or 33. Everything looked good. We ran a fuel check, and everybody's pretty good on fuel, except Bob Escher, who, if he hadn't been horsing around, he would have been with us. But every time Bob Escher got on a flight, he'd be making passes at people. And so when we get back from doing that, he didn't have the fuel. I didn't say anything. It was none of my business. He's my buddy.
I'm trying to think, and this has been your life. You've told this story for decades. But for the rest of us, it's kind of hard to understand or grasp. Have you ever thought about, what if the Hornet wasn't there?
No.
What would have happened to you?
No, that never.
The Wasp has been decimated. Were there people on the ship?
Oh, yeah.
That were killed, you knew?
Oh, yeah. The ones that I did know were friends, but I don't ever remember being greatly, maybe they might have been, but for some reason it didn't strike me as being an untenable situation. There it is. I think we got the answer and let it go. When we got back with the Hornet and got into Espiritu Santo, we didn't know what we were going to do. We had our airplanes, and we had 12 pilots, but nobody said, we're not going to do this to this to this. All of a sudden, we get a message, they need 3 planes. And so Eldridge, he just couldn't wait to get into combat. I'll tell you, we would say, take it easy. Maybe we'll go this way. No, he did. And so the first contingent with three planes. And that lasted one day. Two of the pilots, they couldn't find him. They don't know what happened to him. And Eldridge is by himself now. So he said, send up six more. So they sent up six more. 650 miles one way. They couldn't go back and they couldn't land until it was okay. So when we got there, it was just getting to be dusk. Now, we had a radio for just local use for landing them, you know, and stuff like that. So they told us to circle, that the field was under attack.
That field you're talking about is Henderson Field on Guadalcanal, and you Navy pilots were about to become part of the Cactus Air Force. We all want to hear about it, but it's time for another break. Check out the photos and links relating to Nate's story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.